I thought I was dead in the water after day one.
There's a lot of other good cards out there that are just not being touched yet.
We'll let this controversy rage across the internet.
Force your opponent to have it, and you play to win.
Ponder you can play. Cataxian Probe. Got Mental Misstep.
You could have played the winning deck for about 250.
And if you find one moment of weakness, that's when you go all in on that attack.
This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever done.
Do we have a new Dragon Master on our hands? Oh, you brave soul. Welcome to the post-PT Dominaria Fallout. Who's on the rise? Who couldn't bother to rise up for the weekend? And whose head is heavier wearing the Tryhards crown? It'll all be revealed in this episode of Tryhards. I'm Sean Seacrest, along with Brian Tibbetts and Matt Hurley. We get it started each week here with What Are You Drinking? So, Matt, what did you fill up thine horn with for this episode?
I've got something fancy tonight. I got a glass of champagne. Lauren got home with a bottle of champagne, and we were drinking a little bit of it. After my Thursday and Friday, 2 days of solid golf for work, my boss and I and a couple of the other guys played the good old game of let's see who can drink the most scotch, and there was no winners there.
All right, Brian, while Matt's butler brings him another round, what are you having?
Well, as we all know, it's getting a little warmer outside, and the mosquitoes are getting bad, guys, which means what? That's right. I have to have more quinine, so gin and tonics once again.
When you live in the Midwest, you obviously have your mind on the same thing. After I was out this weekend, I like being outdoors somewhat. I was outdoors much more than I usually am this weekend. So to make sure that I didn't catch anything off those dirty mosquitoes, I'm also going with the quinine vodka on my side of it here in Command Central this evening. We hope you've got something delicious as we're ready to open up on this week's episode of Tryhards. I didn't get to play any Magic this week. I'm also involved in my local disc golf club, and our Quincy Disc Golf Open was this weekend, and I was sort of the assistant tournament director slash for the actual tournament director, and that kept us busy Thursday night going over the course and getting it ready. And then all day Saturday, we had some inclement weather that we had to work around. It ended up being a long day, but ultimately turned out to be a great outing for our club. So I was more than happy to do that. But alas, because of that, I didn't get to play any Magic. Brian, did you get to play any Magic?
Did not get to play any Magic. Watched a ton of coverage of PT, but alas, no slinging of the cardboard for me.
Well, just because all three of us come together on this show, you know by now that all three of us live in different locations, and each one of us has to have an auxiliary battle buddy. And Matt was able to tap his. How was Battlebond this weekend, Matt?
It was a blast. I'm probably saying that because we took first in the first event on Saturday and then third in the event on yesterday. The set, they knocked out of the park. It's a whole hell of a lot of fun. I can't wait to draft it. I actually ended up going with the guy who usually works the shop yesterday. I didn't have a partner. And so we played together, and he was one that took the top eight of the Classic when we had the SCG Louisville. So he's a really good player. And then the previous day was the guy that I don't normally partner with at 2A at Giant, but a good friend of mine that has, I think he's got a few pro points, but he's a very good player. It helped that we opened the Planeswalkers in both my pools. That made our decks pretty easy. Yeah, the partner mechanic is a hell of a mechanic. The assist mechanic, the one that other people can pay your mana, is great. And the set is just fantastic. There's a few cards that break up the slogs, but it two-headed giant sealed relatively slow, but there's enough warrior synergy within this set as well that you can actually have quick ones. I know somebody, one of our friends, they won something like five turns, you know, warrior, and they just curved out and they had the haste warrior too, and it was beaten face. I also pulled the warrior that every time a warrior attacks, put a 1/1 into play and it attacks, and that card is amazing. Yeah, it was just a ton of fun, and I cannot wait. I know they're doing the release. This was the pre-release, so this weekend they're doing the release open house, whatever it's called now. So they have promo cards that they're going to hand out this weekend. They're going to be like the little pre-release cards, but they're going to be two partners. So I'm playing with my normal two-head giant guy this weekend, and I'm super excited about it.
So, Matt, answer me a question about this, because I've seen the Battle Bond, the partner Planeswalkers, the Kenriths.
Yeah, Will and Kenrith.
If one person opens one, then the other person will open it.
They come in the same pack.
They come in the same pack.
Yes. So actually, all the partners are like that. So if you open one, you get the other. And if you open one in foil, you get the other in foil as well.
Wow. So does that seem to set up just an absolute blowout for the people who don't open that?
No, because the Planeswalkers are an anomaly because they're extremely powerful, but they don't protect themselves that well. It's extremely easy to sneak through stuff and kill them, but they are, you know, a must kill. The other ones, you kind of look at them and you say, this is some amazing card advantage, but then it locks you into two colors because all the other ones are two colors. And there's some at uncommon, some at rare, and then the Planeswalkers are mythic. It's going to be you open up one pack, you and your partner are sitting right next to each other. You pick two cards out of that. You have a draft pot of four teams, and then you do six packs that way. So you do left, right, left, right, left, right. So opening up two colors in draft is going to be very similar to first picking a two-color card, which is going to lock you into those colors if you want to continue to get that.
I could see that where you're getting high power, but if you get nothing else to support that, then you're just kind of leaning on the back of those Planeswalkers to carry you the day. So yeah, that does make sense. Were you able to play any of the quote-unquote dual lands?
Yes. Both days we pulled one that were on color. For splashing purposes, they do a great job, and the dual lands are going to be great for multiplayer formats. A huge design. I'm not going to lie, I wish they were fetchable. But, you know, beggars can't be choosers, I guess. They're rare, so it's a little bit of like, I open this, I'd rather, I had a higher impact rare type of thing, but you get that in, you know, anyways. With you drafting with your partner, you could take the rare for mana fixing, and you could take like a high value uncommon. So I think it's going to kind of nullify that, I opened up a crappy rare type of thing.
He wore the crown over the weekend at the Battle Bond release. Who would wear our crown after the Pro Tour Pick'em last weekend? All of us had regrets. It was like doing a draft. All of a sudden, you want some of those cards or players you passed on after seeing how well they achieved over the weekend. But ultimately, one team reigned supreme. Mr. Back-to-Back. He now has four Pro Tour Pick'em titles, supplanting the former leader on this show with three. Matt Hurley takes it down this week. Congratulations. I will note that all of Matt's titles have come in pairs. He won back-to-back and then won back-to-back again. The picks this weekend that took it down for Matt: Ben Stark finishing 307th, Alexander Hayne 94th, and Reed Duke in 15th. Duke really came back from oblivion. He pulled the reverse Corey Baumeister for me. Baumeister finished day one in 10th and then nary won a game in day two and tumbled all the way to 171. Despite that fact, amongst Baumeister, Yasuoka, and PBDDR, Baumeister still my top finisher at 171. So, Sean, outs the new record for futility set this weekend by yours truly. So, you know, if you can't be the best, at least teach a life lesson on your way out the door. And in the running right at the end was Mr. Tibbetts' squad. Tamaharo Saito, 406th. Brad Nelson, 27th. Marcio Carvalho, the love affair is on again, finishing fourth. It was Matt, though, with the 416 taking it down. This was the closest pick'em ever. Not the lowest score, but the closest margin of victory. Matt, your win in this one by 21 points bested the previous gap of you over me in Pro Tour Amon Khet when you won it by 25 points. We had a little bit better picks that time. You won 203 to 228. A win's a win. You take it down 416 to 437. All right. Cue the coronation music. How's the crown feel?
This one feels a little tight because I'm not going to lie. I thought I was dead in the water after day one. It wasn't looking good. None of the people I picked went all the way as far as where I thought their strengths were going to be. It was an oddball. Should have just picked, you know, just your standard, hey, this is going to be a good red-black. I really thought somebody was going to come to the table with innovative deck, and they kind of did with the blue-green decks, but a win's a win, but damn, this one was tight.
Matt, now the all-time leader in the series with four victories, Brian with three, and I'm still with just one thus far. All right, we'll do it again coming up after the core sets release to the next Pro Tour that comes up. I think Pro Tour 25 is going to be the next one, so we'll have a pick'em just before that here on TryHards. Pro Tour Dominaria itself, 460 of the best Magic players in the world descended on Richmond, Virginia, 6 rounds of draft, and 10 rounds of standard. Now, 2 titles were decided this weekend away from the actual tour itself. There will be no draft at Pro Tour 25. It is a team event, so we know that Elias Wasfeldt is your draft master for the year. All he did across 3 Pro Tours was go 16-1-1 in draft. He's earned his seat at Worlds. And Matt Cervera won the Constructed Master title as well. It was Wyatt Darby. Brian referred to him as young blood, I believe. And I thought he was just a fresh-faced young man. He was able to take down Gonzalo Pinto 3-2 in the finals. Mono red in the hands of Darby, pulling off that key glory bringer at the final moment to take down
that
black,
was amazing.
Red, aggro. It was a bit reminiscent of the Kibler flip in my mind, where yep. he had to have it. He flipped it over, and it was the one card that he had. And it's one of the reasons that Kibler is an internet sensation, is that video still holds up over so much time. But guys, as we expand out and look at the top 8, Brian, 4 of the top 8 decks, red, black, aggro. Mono red had 2. Red, black, mid-range, which to my eyes looks just like a pre-sideboarded black, red, aggro deck. And then Esper Control had 1 copy. This was old school Esper Control. Scarab God, Gear Hulk, which you have been agitating for as an addition to control decks, they were really splashing white for Teferi. This was blue-black hard control, and we were all hoping that it would last at least a round or two to shake up this aggro field. Alas, it did not, but I thought this was an interesting showcase. The knock has been that pros won't play aggro. We now know that it's not just Ifro who will play this. If it's a good deck, the pros will play what gives them the best chance to win, and you saw it in the collateral damage against control all weekend long.
Yeah, this was a really, really fun deck to just kind of look at the list from a brewing point of view to kind of see how much they're leveraging the black and the blue, but really splashing for white, because Teferi really is just that good, and there's some other cards in white that you get that really do allow you to come out of the sideboard a little bit better, Forsake the Worldly being the big one. I love this list a lot. I feel like it might need to be a little more fine-tuned. It's not nearly as fast as those aggro decks. So 4 Vraska's Contempt, when you're leaning on 4 mana removals in game 1 and game 2, that's really asking a lot. The cast downs did a ton of work. I can't imagine going into a battle nowadays without Torrential Gearhulk or Scarab God in any combination of numbers, whatever the right numbers might be. But I feel like those 2 cards are so good against so many different things that are going to be thrown at you. So congrats to Ernest Lim Pejin for this list and for watching him. His play over the Pro Tour, I thought, was just locked in, and he just didn't draw well sometimes. And that's what it came down to.
Matt, let's widen the lens out a bit here and look at all of the standard decks that finished with at least 8 wins. So that'd be 24 points over the weekend. You take a look at that, 7 red-black aggro decks, 4 mono-red decks, 4 red-black mid-range decks, 2 Steel Leaf Stompies, and then 1 each of Esper Control, black-white. That one featured History of Benalia, and then 1 blue-white Teferi deck. When you look at those numbers and put them all together, that's the 20 decks that finished with at least 24 points in standard. You start to get a little bit better picture of what the pros were utilizing and what was really having a good percentage of the metagame go its way. And we'll talk about conversion rates and saturation numbers in a moment. But no matter how wide we pull back on the scope, black-red seems like it's having its moment in the sun right now.
Oh, it is. A lot of people are testing because of end of the month is Nationals, and then SCG Con, people are going there. It was black red or mono red everywhere. I mean, honestly, it was Goblin Chain Whirlers everywhere. Looking at the formats, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, do we ride this out until Kaladesh rotates 3 months, I think? You know, is there too many Chain Whirlers out there? Do these decks lose enough at rotation that they can just kind of put something else into, you know, into these decks to replace it? You can't play X1s right now. That's what's happening. And these red-black decks are just controlling the board, and they're efficiently beating down as well, very efficiently beating down. You've got a lot of recursion. You've got your Phoenixes. You've got Evasion. So if you're playing Kerry Zevs, you've got your Heart of Kirin's, the Scrap Heap Scroungers that come back. And then, of course, you've got your board control and chain whirlers. Yeah, I mean, then you've got your glory bringer. So it's just, you're always on the back foot when you're playing against these decks, and I don't know what the proper foil is to them.
Let's take a look at the day one metagame percentage and then the conversion rate. You lump black-red aggro and black-red midrange kind of together. They were 26.5% of the field on day one. They were the only deck that eclipsed 20%, and they picked up a conversion rate of nearly 69% and became an even bigger slice of the day two meta at 29%. If you group control decks together, I'm thinking that's anything with Teferi. They were 19.5% of day one. They enjoyed a 59% conversion rate and were just 18% of day two. Mono red aggro, 10% of the field, converted nearly 80% to 13% of the field on day two. Steel Leaf Stompy decks were just 8.7% of the field, but had a pretty good conversion rate of 57% and were 8% of the field again on day two. The numbers really get smaller after that with Benalia decks, Constrictor decks, and then sort of everything else that showed up to play. But Brian, as you look at that, does that make you want to attack this metagame, or does it say to you, hey, I need to pick one of these sort of top three, or maybe if I think Steel Leaf Stompy is a foil for the top three, top four decks going forward?
It's always time to brew. I think one of the things that I was a little frustrating about this Pro Tour was none of the decks that we saw either day one or day two, with the exception of a couple of cards or maybe, you know, a mishmash here and there, maybe the Esper being the one that I kind of raised my eyebrows a little bit about. None of the decks really showed us anything that we hadn't seen before. And that's always, to me, says, okay, something's stale. And maybe this is just the modern player in me coming out like, hey, anything can win. Anything can win. Well, you just gave us the numbers. Not everything can win. The History of Benalia decks were like nowhere to be seen. Control obviously did not do very well against all of these aggro decks. I don't like seeing basically one control deck and then a bunch of red decks in the top eight of the Pro Tour. Yeah, they were calling them red-black mid-range and red-black aggro and mono-red aggro. They're all red decks. There's not very many black cards at all. And so to me, that just means, yeah, there's a lot of other good cards out there in the standard format that are just not being touched yet. And guys, it's time to brew. People out there, come on, let's get going. There's other decks out there that we can have. I know we've got only 3.5 months left, but hey, summer, the living's easy. Let's get this done and shake things up before we have some rotation in the fall.
Matt, I know you were busy with Two-Headed Giant. How much of the top eight did you get to watch? I sat down and really digested all of it. And the thing that jumped out to me was the multifaceted skill set that the pros put on display with these aggro decks, knowing when to leverage their removal, when to use it on the board, when to go to the face in order to change the clock, how to attack for the maximum amount of damage without letting yourself open to an alpha strike to lose the game. That was a skill on display in the final turn of the Pro Tour. And I'm sure we'll talk about that at length in just a moment, but it's a different skill set than draw go. And it was refreshing in my mind to watch it. Brian has said this before. We pretty much grew up on the game as control players once we figured out that Crawworm wasn't the end all be all. One of the things that this weekend pointed out to me as a hole in my game is that I don't attack a game the way you have to be successful with these decks. To play for the win, maybe you don't have it in hand. Maybe you're leaving yourself open to a top deck. Maybe you give your opponent just enough rope to hang themselves. But to play for the win, as opposed to playing the game not to lose. Not playing scared in the sports sense, but in the control sense of playing the game not to lose. Did you notice that in watching coverage as well? And is that part of your game that you use very often?
I always call or equate that to forcing your opponent to have it. So, like, over the weekend, this is something we were talking about, you know, learning from each other. And one of the things I actually brought up, and this was well before we had this conversation tonight, was that I'm like, you know, I'm okay sacrificing some of my early bombs if it gets the opponent's removal out of their hand so that my later bombs that will win me the game, if they stick around, then I'm good. I think that's kind of the same mindset there, where you have to force your opponent to have it and you play to win. Versus just saying, well, you know what, there's a, you know, maybe there's a 20% chance they have this. I can't make this play. It's not a safe attack. I can't do it. So you can't play with that mindset. And I did notice that, especially when you have cards like Unlicensed Disintegration running around. Part of that, too, falls back on Glorybringer because, you know, once Glorybringer hits a field, that's a haste removal card, like Flame Tongue Cavu. It can just blow out your board. So I think part of that is, you know, just saying, okay, I need to aggressively go after my opponent here.
Brian, are you ready to tap out of your comfort zone, or are you going to retreat to the welcoming, sheltered arms of Teferi?
I got to tell the quick story here. So I was out grocery shopping, as I mentioned earlier, and I was waiting in this god-awful line to check out, and I was watching, it was at the finals, I want to say game five of the finals, and Pinto had just played some cards, pretty much wiped Darby's board, and then they traded Rekindling Phoenix, and then they both got the egg, and then he played a follow-up Chain Whirler, which took out Darby's, you know, little egg, and it was like, I was like, ouch, this is over. Then I get back into the car after another, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes, I see Marshall Sutcliffe about ready to do the trophy presentation, and I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see Pinto on here, and here comes Darby walking on here, and I'm like, what the hell? So I call Sean. I'm like, what? You got to explain to me what just happened. So he kind of went through this whole thing about not playing to lose, because that's basically what Pinto did. He wasn't nearly as aggressive enough with his red deck. And I'm like, why would you play a red deck and not be aggressive with it? That just seems crazy. But I think in this Pro Tour, you saw people, they were trying to outthink the other opponent, when what does a red deck do best? Just turn your creature sideways and attack. And if you find one moment of weakness, that's when you go all in on that attack. And I think it would have turned out a lot differently. I'm still of the mind, if you have me choose between these aggro decks, these red-black aggro decks, and the blue-white control or Esper control deck, I will pick the control deck 10 times out of 10 because I just like the play style better. I just do. And I love finding out, you know, glimmers of genius and the commits and the pulls from tomorrow. Finding out just that constant thinking of what can I get, what can I get, what can I get? Hey, should I seal away? Should I settle? What should I do here? I think there's just so much more play to those decks, and that just appeals to me personally. And maybe that's one reason why the playing to win mentality is just something that it's a little unforgivable for somebody who's piloting a red deck and just doesn't carry it through all the way to fruition. So that's a little harsh, but that's the way I'm feeling right now.
I think it was an excellent final between Wyatt Darby and Gonzalo Pinto. Darby getting up 2-0, Pinto coming back in major fashion to take it to game five, and then that huge Glorybringer flip to win it for Wyatt Darby. Do we have a new Dragon Master on our hands? We'll let this controversy rage across the internet to figure that out. As good as that final was, we were just a card flip or two away from a final of Carvalho versus Turtenwald. Those are two of the titans in the sport. Brian, set aside for a moment that you had picked Marcio Carvalho in the Pro Tour Pick'em. Do you think WotC has a rooting interest in some of the bigger names in the sport at this point? For instance, in Major League Baseball, it's no secret that the office of Major League Baseball would love to have New York play LA in the World Series. You've got huge demographics. You have both coasts involved. You have a culture clash. It makes for great TV and big dollars. Two Midwestern cities, not going to bring as big of a crowd necessarily to national TV eyes. Do you think it's right for WotC to have a rooting interest? I'm not saying they do. Do you think they were thinking, oh, we could see Carvalho versus Turtenwald, and this is going to be huge? We got a great finals between Darby and Pinto. What do you think Wizards' role was there, or do you think they just really don't care that much who it is in that final moment?
I don't think they do care who it is in that final moment, because obviously the people have earned it. They've earned the spot in those final seats. But as an event that's tied to a business, and we've said this countless times on the cast, Wizards is in the business of selling Magic cards and making money on Magic cards, providing great experiences for all of us, of course, but in the end, selling cardboard to us. And so I think it would be remiss if there weren't some employees of Wizards who weren't planning for what happens if two titans of the game sit down in the final seats. That would just be silly, because if they're caught flat-footed on that and to celebrate that, that would just be a little irresponsible in some ways. So yeah, it probably crossed some people's minds. I would have loved to see it. And at the same time, it's always good to root for those people whom you have no idea, or someone, you know, who lives in Iowa City, Iowa, where I used to live, and has a huge following on gaming pages in this neck of the woods. So, and again, Turtenwald being, you know, a Wisconsin boy, a Midwestern boy, that's always kind of fun, rooting for those regional heroes, as it were.
Well, we are chained to this next stop on covering this pro tour. Matt, you brought this up first. Let's have the conversation about it. Goblin Chain Whirler was nearly perfect in the top eight. We haven't seen this level of penetration since the halcyon days of Jace the Mind Sculptor. Chain Whirler had a possible 32 copies in the top eight. He had only put 28 in there. We don't have to worry about this taking over the format, right? You, amongst the three of us, have been most on the wagon of Chain Whirler is warping the format. Is this just a good card that we're going to adapt to? Or do you really want to talk about having to unholster the Banhammer?
Frankly, I don't know. Ideally, here's what I would like to see. I think they'd be safe in saying we're banning Chain Whirler, we're unbanning Rampaging Ferocidon, and then going through and stating the facts. This ban would be much different from the previous bans. The previous bans were just where the card was so good you had to play it. This card is so good that you don't have to play it, but it warps the format. And I think there's an important distinction there. The issue is I don't think that people, and when I say people, I mean Magic players, understand that distinction. And I don't think they can separate, oh, another ban, you know, oh, we're up in arms. I don't think they can separate that out. I think if they had a good write out to say, here's why we banned Chain Whirler, unbanned Ferocidon, maybe, I don't know. Moving forward, we're going to have play design, review these all the time, and kind of have a truly fluid format. Plus, it's a rare. Worst case scenario, you're out $30. I mean, let's be real here. I think the highest these spiked to were like $8. I think we could write it out until rotation, or if they put an answer for it. I don't know what the answer would be if they put a good answer for it in the core sets. I think this is a pivotal moment for Standard and for Wizards, though. Frankly, I think they were so afraid of Land War Elves, they made Goblin Chain Whirler, and that is the much more offensive card.
Brian, come through the turnstile and pick a team.
No, no more bans. No more bans. Here's the thing, though. Kind of frustrates me that the bannings that are even being discussed, whether it's by us or seriously, is all red cards, right? It's Rampaging Ferocidon, and now it's possibly Chain Whirler. Is red that much overpowered? Or again, back to earlier in the show, what we were talking about, have people just not brewed? Have people just gotten a little complacent and lazy and just kind of let the work be done by others and haven't found those other builds, those other cards that can be, take advantage of these kinds of things? Rampaging Ferocidon, I feel like, had the biggest text line that gave it the biggest problem was not menace, was not that it did a damage, it's that players can't gain life. That seems to me to be just absolutely bonkers, because if you have a Lyra, the Lyra is the absolute foil to a red deck. But if Rampaging Ferocidon is saying you can't gain life, well, 5/5 flying first strike is great, but lifelink is what gets you, you know, to par with those red decks with all the direct damage and with all the creatures that are happening. So to have one card be able to blank your Lyras, I think it is the big problem. I am absolutely opposed to banning something right now. I still think there's ways to deal with these red decks. We haven't seen the optimal ways yet. Obviously, it's a little disheartening to know that the pros can't even do it. And that's why we had 28 copies of Chain Whirler in the top eight. But I don't look at this card pool and say, oh, it's absolutely skewed one way. There's so much power across the levels. We've just got to be better at mining the power.
There is a line of text on both cards that I think is important, but I think it's the very top line. I think you're inviting even more damage because of the splashable nature of Ferocidon with a 2 generic and a red casting cost versus the limitations inherently placed on Chain Whirler by the triple red casting cost. So I think that is a limiting factor, and it's one that I would kind of move the needle in favor of keeping Chain Whirler in the format over Ferocidon, if that's part of the equation. I don't think it has to be one or the other, either or both. But I don't think it's time to ban anything right now. Let the format sort itself out and let players come up with an answer to Chain Whirler as we go forward. Guys, before we move on from the Pro Tour, Matt, this popped up in my mind, and I want to get your reaction to it. When a card overperforms at a Pro Tour or at a GP or at any big Magic event, one that hadn't been high on the fiscal radar prior to its success over that weekend, we are fast as a community to jump on it, to send its stock skyrocketing. We all love a winner, and I understand how that happens. Why aren't we so quick on the flip side of that coin? Teferi had a relatively abysmal showing this weekend, and yet it still has financial traction. Why, in your mind, do Magic stocks spike overnight, but they never crash overnight? Is it because of dealer investment? Is it because of the emotional investment to cards? If we were just rating these on performance alone, shouldn't Teferi have tumbled 35, 50% after this weekend?
No, because the supply and the demand don't balance out perfectly in Magic, and it's because of the mentality of Magic players, which is fear of missing out. They see something perform, they're like, oh, what if I want to play that deck? Oh my God, I better buy that right now. And then they buy it, but then the cards, and I'm guilty. I'm not guilty of the first one, but I'm guilty of the second one. Then the cards sit in binders and they say, well, wait, I pay $10 for this. I'm not going to sell it at $7 because it fell off 30% because it didn't perform. It's not going back into the ecosystem because people aren't buying them because they did not perform. It's very much an emotional thing, but that's all there is to it. It's just purely emotions that are being played to in there.
All right. It was so refreshing over the weekend to see a deck not just compete, but dominate the top eight and ultimately win that you could have bought for $250 before this weekend, maybe plus or minus $25, deciding on a few, if you went with this many copies of this or this many copies of that. We're a long way from the days of Mythic where it was $1,100 for a competitive standard deck. You could have played the winning deck for about $250 coming into this weekend. So I don't want to hear anymore, I'm priced out of standard. The deck that won the Pro Tour prior to its weekend of winning, you could have gotten for in the neighborhood of $250 if you just walked in off the street without owning a Magic card in your collection and purchased them all at retail. Guys, as we come up on the other action coming up this weekend, GP Copenhagen is going to be standard. We'll see if we see any iterating on the Pro Tour format. And SCG is having their convention. They'll have their Invitational. That's modern and standard. They're going to have a variety of classics, but the one that has drawn some raised eyebrows, no ban list modern. What is the banned card in Modern that you would build around, Brian?
Treasure Cruise. Absolutely Treasure Cruise. I feel like the power of Blue-Red Delver in Legacy before they banned Treasure Cruise is absolutely going to be on display this weekend. I can't imagine that a bunch of the field is not showing up with this because you've still got things like Ponder you can play. You've got Gitaxian Probe, got Mental Misstep. You're going to fill up that graveyard, obviously, with fetch lands as well. And Treasure Cruising for three with that Delver deck, I think, is just absolutely bonkers. So that's the card that I would love, love, love to play again in Modern.
Matt, what banned card would you be sleeving up?
Stoneforge Mystic. I think Blue-White Control, a Stoneboy deck with Chromox, maybe Mental Misstep. I'm not sure how many one drops would be played. You're getting Ponder, Preordain, Mental Misstep, Batterskull, Stoneforge, and Treasure Cruise. I think that's how you win. I think these Protean Hulk decks are going to be Glass Cannon decks.
I think that the Treasure Cruise is on everybody's radar, but the one that I'm interested in trying to break in half that maybe people wouldn't be ready for, Hypergenesis. There's a way to make Hypergenesis work. There's a reason it's on the ban list. All right, have fun if you're going to get crazy at SCG Con this weekend. Guys, RPTQs sold out over the weekend. Brian, the Shark Tank was heavily involved in this situation, as you've mentioned. What was the reaction, and what's your feeling about the RPTQ format that ended up being a little bit hard to handle, it sounds like?
It was just the fact that they gave you a window, and you had to register your unified standard team. The issue is one person qualifies through the PPTQ, And then you then had to get, you know, two schlubs to go along with you for the Team Unified Standard at the RPTQ. Well, you start looking at the dates, and first of all, travel became kind of an issue because the closest one to us, I think, was 5.5 hours away. One was in Independence, Missouri. The other one was up in Minneapolis. And so you're like, okay, well, we're going to drive. And then you start looking at it, and you're like, oh, this one over here in Kansas City is almost sold out, and this one over in Independence is sold out. Well, I guess we got to go to Minneapolis. And they did. They got registered. Everything's fine. They're going up at the end of the month. I think everything worked out, but I'm wondering how many teams out there did not get to go, A, for travel reasons, or B, because the TOs did not allow for enough players to inhabit their domain. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I get it that they might have been caught flat-footed, but to me, that speaks of a communication issue between either WOTC and the TOs or the TOs not understanding, you know, what kind of space they need. If you're going to open up an RPTQ and expect a lot of people to be there, but these are teams of three. Again, it's kind of like when you do a two-headed giant format, you have to plan for each team to have two chairs there, right? That's just simple math. So I want to make sure that hopefully no one gets shut out of an RPTQ that really wants to go because they've just capped it. And that's part of the issue that I'm seeing out there. And if so, Wizards has a problem on its hands. They've got to open up some other stores to offer these. Other stores have to make themselves available. Something has to happen, because if you're going to basically triple your attendance just by the format you've chosen, that is a real issue.
Matt, isn't this just something that the WPN has to have logistically kept store owners abreast of?
Yeah, and I don't know what happened. I mean, I'll be honest. Somebody didn't think, or stores didn't communicate up to WPN. Maybe WPN assumed that stores knew it would be three times the people. The other issue people are having is not just them being sold out, but pricing. Some of these places are charging $50, $60, $75 to play in these tournaments, and they're like, I can go to a GB and play that. I played through a PPTQ. You know, I understand they have to pay for wherever they're holding it, you know, venues, especially if their store's too small. A lot of people are complaining because, you know, there's somebody, I was one of them out west, was charging $75. You get a lot out of it, but they need to standardize on the pricing. They need to do similar to what they did with Channel Fireball. You know, stop this bad communication. I mean, this is just Wizards doing what Wizards does, and that's screwing things up sometimes.
This seems to be the year of the team format, so we'll see what kind of growth Wizards experiences out of this. And I don't mean in the player base. I mean in the handling, the logistics, the understanding for what it takes when you want to have some of these team formats easy at a GP level, easy at a pro tour level where you have that level of planning, maybe not so easy on the RPPTQ and RPTQ level. We'll see how this turns out. I hope everyone gets their seats, literally. Speaking of earning an opportunity, Wizards' newest digital brainchild keeps bumping up against its older brother. Wizards has made a couple of announcements that are going to take Arena into the future, and that future is going to be here in the next 36 hours after this is released.
It looks like we'll have our full standard environment on Arena June 7th. We're going to have three game sets with full sideboard by June 7th. Also, 24 hours a day of drafts as well, so you're not just limited to normal drafts. Because you don't have to fight for cards, they fixed a bunch of key cards, and people will be getting two of each of those. And then everyone will be getting the welcome decks, because there are welcome decks that are in standard currently. Now, my big question here is, yeah, we have to test it. We have to do all this stuff. But I guess I just don't understand why they put all this work into these sets when it's going to rotate in 2 months. I mean, we still got another month or two of beta left, I'm sure. But I just don't understand that. And then also, they said, you know, after this, we've got more big announcements. So I'm hoping that they fix the economy, not make it a nightmare to try out a bunch of different decks like you currently have to. Hey, you know what? We're going to have a full standard, you know, a lot easier to play. And then they're also redoing the matchmaking as well. So you're not always going to be paired up. If you're a bronze player, you're not going to be paired up against a gold star three or platinum star three or wherever they're called.
I think that was just a chorus of angels I heard start the hallelujah. That was an answer to one of my prayers and some of the matchmaking that was going on when I was last getting to put some time into Arena. Brian, I haven't lately, but I think I'm ready to again. One of my biggest problems was the one game situation, because it led to some fabulously skewed tactics, because you'd never had to pay the piper and play a sideboard game. Now that this is going to feel a little bit more like paper magic, I think I'm ready to jump back in and play some more. What about you?
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to this. Having more cards to pull from, I felt really comfortable in the Kaladesh milieu. I'm really happy that they're doing this. And I think hopefully that's going to open up, like I was talking about earlier, the brew space to maybe explore some of these strategies that have maybe been ignored. And, you know, what's going to knock Red off the pedestal of being that only deck that people want to play?
Well, there will certainly be financial implications from any decisions Wizards makes with Arena. We'll see how those bear out throughout the community. Speaking of financial decisions, he's about to help you try and make one. Don't worry, you disagree, he won't fly to your house and actually rip up your cards. We think that's pretty much just a passive-aggressive threat. Matt, what's in the elevator with you this week here on Try Hard?
A Johnny Unyielding. I want to pick up the foils. The foils are ridiculously cheap, under $5 for a good 6-drop Planeswalkers. That's bonkers to me. As a bonus on this, the new white card, the Academy Rector, but for Planeswalkers, I think this is going to see a slow gain over time. If you're trading out some overpriced Battle Bond cards this weekend, pick up some foil of Johnny Unyieldings, throw them in a box somewhere, forget about them for a year, and they're going to be a $10, $12, $15 card in about a year and a half.
That's the second head of finance coming in there. A battle bonded in the elevator this week here on Tryhards. That brings us up to this week's 3 minutes to brew. Ryan, I'm ready to brew after watching the Pro Tour this weekend. What do you got?
The more I watched the Pro Tour, the more I kept thinking, gosh, there's so many powerful cards, and Dominaria just gave us so many legendaries and so many sagas and so many artifacts that we could use. What's going on here? We've got to get these onto the battlefield, and what better way to get them onto the battlefield than not to cast them, but to just activate them off Thran's Temporal Gateway. So legendary artifact, Thran's Temporal Gateway, costs 4. And for 4 and tap it, you may put a historic permanent card from your hand onto the battlefield. Guys, this seems to me to be a very, very powerful card. I feel like there's enough high-end, top-end historics in Dominaria, in Ixalan and Amonkhet, and in Kaladesh, even for the next couple months, that we could really, you know, build a big, go big deck. And maybe this is my homework for the next couple weeks. So I'm curious, do you think Thran's Temporal Gateway has what it takes to maybe have something for standard, or is this just going to be relegated to, as all our good cards are, EDH? Hurley, I'm going to start with you on Thran's Temporal Gateway.
So I've actually brewed with this card a little bit. If this was a 3 mana to drop and then 4 mana to put a historic permanent into play, I think it'd be great. But there's just not any huge historic permanents in standard that I'm like, oh, I just want to put this into play, go from 4 and then on turn 5 put it into play. I mean, unless we get something that is like an Ugin, I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I tried this with Karn and then with Wrath. I think that card is amazing. Like I said, I mean, there's just nothing I can see that you get value out of that is, you know, just broken. Maybe you're doing it in a Grixis deck with Nicol Bolas. Maybe you could even do it in like a Dinosaur Ramp deck with like Gisheth. But I just could not find that magic one that was like, here, this is the one I want. This is what I always want to be putting in play, and I win the game off of this. But I just think right now it's just too slow, and there's nothing just broken as broken can be within the format currently.
You know, my first inclination is to pair this up with Wrath Capuchin, because you have the same payoffs for playing these two cards. That's the ability to play at instant speed with your legendaries. And Thran's Temporal Gateway itself is legendary, so that leads me to the next card, which is a way to power it out earlier, which is Mox Amber. Is this the card that we want in a possible deck to use Mox Amber in order to get ahead of the other decks in the format? My first inclination is to go Bant with this because of what Matt was talking about, and that's getting those huge things. Powering out and a Johnny Unyielding, being able to work around the text on Gehalta rather than having to play to the board and get swept up by Fumigate. I think these are some of the cards that you would consider. And you, I think you're going to have to play white because you're going to be a little bit slower, most likely. So you're going to be the Fumigate deck.
I kind of look at this card as maybe Standard's answer to something like a Legacy Reanimator, where you just want to get big creatures into your chosen place. First of all, this is your hand in Standard and your graveyard in Legacy. And then you use the power of Thran's Temporal Gateway to get them onto the battlefield where you want, just like in Legacy, cheap, you know, reanimation spells. I don't want to be limited to colors here. I would fill my deck with couple of each of the biggest hitters, the Galt of Primal Hunger, Planeswalkers. I would say Thran would be a big one if you go artifact-based, like Hurley was saying. The Sun's Avatar. Really do this and just lean on Thran's Temporal Gateway, and then you're really going to splash blue for probably Negate to just take care of the counter spells for Unlicensed Disintegration, or Sorcerer's Spyglass to really make sure you can get your spells to stick. I really like this idea. I really like the fact that, you know, you can maybe just put some really, really broken things onto the battlefield. And as soon as you get up to four, you're just kind of untapped, waiting for your opponent to declare end step. And then, you know, you can go to town, untap, and do some silly thing. I think it's got some good ideas. Obviously, it's going to take some work to get it done. But this is going to be my homework for the next couple weeks.
Thran Temporal Gateway, our 3 minutes to brew this week. Here on Tryhards. That brings us up to what we did to get better at Magic this week. For me, it was simply watching the Pro Tour. What I talked about earlier, watching the skill set on display in that Sunday top eight and seeing where I have some holes in my game and the things that I need to work on. Brian, what'd you do to get better at Magic this week?
Same thing, watching the Pro Tour, but I also got some really, really good news from the local scene here. Someone has bought the local shop. A longtime gamer slash grinder. The community, it looks like, has welcomed him with open arms. The shop is currently closed while he just kind of gets things in order, but sent him a really nice note. Really looking forward to meeting him face to face and getting down to the shop and, you know, establishing that community again, trying to say, hey, I'm the ambassador. I want to be that guy to kind of reach out, figure out, you know, answer the questions that you have. What can I do to help you get this up and running and make it a great place to play Magic again?
Matt, what'd you do to get better at Magic this week?
I played some super casual, ridiculous Magic. That was a blast. It didn't matter for anything, and I loved it. That sounds weird to say that, but after that ass whooping I took a couple weeks ago, I needed not this victory, but I needed just to say, oh my gosh, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever done, and it was a ton of fun. And I'm looking forward to doing it again this weekend.
Whether your next stop is Battle Bond or the next PT, we hope you can get there. Though, you brave soul, thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Tryhards. We'll see you again next week.